Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 27th of June, these are our main stories. Reports from Bolivia say there's been a military coup attempt in the city of La Paz. But later, the president was able to make an address on social media from inside a palace. Women across the US may win the right to have an abortion in a medical emergency as a result of a Supreme Court ruling. And President Ruto of Kenya has abandoned planned tax rises in response to deadly protests on Tuesday. Also in this podcast,
there are a couple of issues that they're looking at, a helium leak being one, and thruster issues being the other.
With such problems, will two astronauts stranded on the International Space Station return to planet Earth? We begin in Bolivia. The scenes on Wednesday in the city of La Paz were, for a number of hours, reminiscent of earlier moments in Latin America's history. Tanks surrounding government buildings, men in uniform apparently facing off against those who were elected, the government denouncing an attempted coup d'etat. As we record this podcast, it's still hard to work out what exactly is happening in Bolivia, but we know that army units had surrounded government buildings in La Paz. At one stage, witnesses told the Reuters news agency that an armoured vehicle had driven through the entrance of the presidential palace. During the events on Wednesday, the government spokeswoman, Minister Maria Nella Prada, seemed to suggest they were under siege.
I want to denounce before the Bolivian people and the international community an attempted coup d'etat here in Bolivia. I am Marianela Prada, government spokesperson. I'm in the presidential palace. Murillo Square has been taken over by military tanks and military troops. We understand that it's a faction of the army. They've removed people from the square and are not allowing others to enter.
Then, later, the scenario changed. I spoke to our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, who gave me the latest on Wednesday's events.
It looks like the troops that were in this main square surrounding the buildings, they have left now. But we don't know what that exactly means, because we saw the pictures of this tank, as you mentioned, entered, crashing the gates of the presidential palace. We saw pictures of the president surrounded by troops inside the palace. And about half an hour later, the president went on social media and made a statement. He appointed new military commanders. He urged people to take to the streets, and he said he was going to defeat this coup. A few moments later, the troops left this square. We don't know if this is over or if this is still ongoing. But what we have now is a situation that's very worrying and very concerning in Bolivia.
Has there been any official word from the army or any factions of the army which might be involved in what does look like an attempted coup?
No, this army commander, General Zuniga, he said he was changing the cabinet, that the army just couldn't watch things going on. I mean, it's the president is a center-left president, and the army has been at odds with left-wing governments in Bolivia for a while. So we couldn't just watch this happening, and we're going to change the government. He even announced that he was going to release political prisoners, which you presume is a former president who was put in jail a few years ago. So after that, we had the deployment of these troops from the central area of the city. But you have to remember that Bolivia has two realities. You have the highlands, the mountains, the Andes, where the support is for the government and for the left. And you have the lowlands that are more productive and rich part of the country, Santa Cruz, where the support has been for right-wing governments and probably the government, the military. So I don't know if that will carry on if this is over.
Leonardo Rocha. The rules on abortion in the U.S. state of Idaho are among the toughest in the country. Women are not allowed an abortion, even in a medical emergency. At least for now, the Supreme Court seems to have accidentally posted its draft ruling on a case that could change that. President Biden's administration had argued that America's national law takes precedence, And this says that hospitals must make an abortion available to a woman who needs it in an emergency. States, they insisted, have no right to override this. And as our correspondent in Washington, Nomia Iqbal, explained to me, the Supreme Court's potential decision could have major implications for women across the country, as well as those in Idaho itself.
What this means, and that is if this draft does go on to become the official ruling, is that any pregnant woman that goes into an emergency room in Idaho State and needs stabilizing treatment, she will be able to get an abortion. That will be included as a treatment. What this case essentially was about was, can women get that? Idaho is a very conservative state. It has a near-total abortion ban. And President Biden's administration had said Idaho state law is breaching the federal law, which is known as EMTALA, by not providing abortion care in certain cases where it is medically necessary. And what this document, what it's seeming to indicate, is that the court is voting 6-3 to rule against Idaho on what appears to be technical issues.
If this draft ruling does go ahead, does that mean it applies in all states, not just Idaho, that no matter what any state wants to do, national law means that a woman who needs an abortion in an emergency situation will be able to get it?
That's correct. EMTALA will be the main law in all of this. It's a federal law. And that is President Biden's administration's argument, that federal law takes precedent and state law cannot breach it by not providing abortion care in certain cases where it is medically necessary.
Now, I gather that this draft ruling was posted accidentally. People weren't supposed to hear about it just yet.
It was inadvertently posted and then it was removed from the website. The Supreme Court confirmed to the BBC that it did inadvertently post this online. We have seen the document. We have gone through it so we can verify it in that respect. But the Supreme Court, you know, will stress that this is not the final ruling. This was just a draft. And we don't know exactly when we will get that final ruling. We should find out at some point before their term finishes.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Next, to the UK.
In 9 days' time, one of the two men standing here will be Prime Minister. Tonight, they go head-to-head. Welcome to the BBC Prime Ministerial Debate.
A fanfare heralding the start of what will be the last leaders' debate in Britain's general election campaign. And for once, the arguments managed to live up to that dramatic musical introduction. Sort of. Britain's Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, was long regarded as a safe pair of hands technocrat, rather than one of the Conservative Party's sound and fury tub-thumpers. Now, that has changed somewhat over the last few weeks. Mr. Sunak is very much the underdog in this contest, polls predicting he'll lose badly to the Labour Party and its leader, Keir Starmer. Fighting for his political life, the Prime Minister has manifested previously unseen mettle, no more so than when harrying his opponent on the issue of illegal immigration.
What will you happen? Process
it's
their claims.
It's a very simple question. I can tell people what I will do with them. I will put them on planes to Rwanda because they shouldn't be able to stay.
Years.
What will you do with illegal
years.
Migrants who come
Honestly,
to our country? What will you do with them? It's a simple question.
His plan is
what
to
What will
take...
you do with them?
There was a time when the vast majority of British voters plumped either for the Conservatives or Labour. Not now, though. Challengers like the Green Party and the more right-wing party Reform and the centrist Liberal Democrats are sucking up support as never before. It was typical that this question proved popular before anyone even had a chance to answer it.
Are you two really the best we've got to be the next Prime Minister of our great country?
Well, I spoke to our political correspondent, Rob Watson, who watched the debate. I asked him whether the Prime Minister or his challenger had managed to win anyone over.
It's always an incredibly difficult question to answer, Paul. I mean, I can certainly tell you that the people who asked those questions, and you heard one of them there, that sort of, oh my goodness, is this the best they can offer? I mean, they weren't impressed by the answers that they heard. I mean, whether people watching were impressed. It would have been quite a difficult watch. I mean, they were fighty. There was lots of sort of shouting over each other. They were both extremely combative. I mean, I guess I can only answer your question, Paul, by saying that there have been lots and lots of debates in this election campaign so far, and they've really just barely had any effect whatsoever on the opinion polls, with Labour, as you said, still having a pretty whopping lead.
So much for the tone of the debate. What were the main issues that the two were arguing about this evening?
Well, the main issues were the ones that you might have predicted. I mean, one was about trust in politicians, which is an all-time low in this country. And then it was broadly about the economy, with essentially Rishi Sunak saying, my goodness, under the left-of-centre Labour Party, everyone would be paying higher taxes. And essentially Keir Starmer making the argument that, look, under 14 years of the Conservatives, living standards have stagnated, and there's been a sort of general level of chaos and instability. And there was also a proper ding-dong on the question of immigration, with, again, Mr Sunak saying, look, immigration would go up under Labour, but with Mr Starmer retorting, hang on a minute, immigration has been at absolute record highs for the last 14 years the Conservatives have been in power.
Briefly, Rob, I mentioned those smaller parties doing better than previously in British politics. Are they likely to do well, do you think, the Greens and that further right party Reform?
I think the short answer to your question, Paul, is absolutely yes. I think they may well have the biggest share since the 1920s. But because of Britain's electoral system, the first past the post disproportional system, it's possible that they may get a whacking historic share of the vote away from the two main parties, but still not win that many seats.
Rob Watson. 23 people were killed, the country's parliament was ransacked and set on fire. The army called out to quell the protests. But now it seems that demonstrators who took to the streets of Kenya's capital, Nairobi, on Tuesday have got what they wanted, or at least achieved their main professed goal. Kenya's president, William Ruto, has cancelled plans for a new finance bill which would have put up taxes.
Having reflected on the continuing conversation around the content of the Finance Bill 2024 and listening keenly to the people of Kenya who have said loudly that they want nothing to do with this Finance Bill 2024, I concede, and therefore I will not sign the 2024 Finance Bill.
Raising taxes was supposed to be a way to help get Kenya's finances in order. Instead of doing that, President Ruto has said he will cut the amount spent by his own politicians.
Starting with the office of the president, operational expenditure in the presidency be reduced to remove allocations for the confidential fort, reduce travel, hospitality, purchase of motor vehicles, renovations, and other expenditures.
It's not just about the money. President Ruto's whole attitude on Wednesday seemed to be about making amends and reaching out to those who had risen up against his government. He said he would now enter into dialogue with young people who were at the forefront of Tuesday's protests. And yet, his conciliatory tone may be too late, with the toll from Tuesday's police crackdown still being assessed. Davis Malombe is executive director of the Kenyan Human Rights Commission. He says that as well as the near two dozen deaths, more than 100 people were being treated for gunshot wounds, and President Ruto is responsible.
Mr. Ruto has overseen a planned and executable massacre against peaceful protesters and also other Kenyans who came to support across the country to reject the punitive finance bill. The police shot young unarmed protesters outside parliament, with their killing going into the night.
With the situation in Kenya so polarised, few predicted such a rapid concession by the country's president. So why, I asked our Africa correspondent Barbara Platt-Usher, did Mr Ruto back down?
I think the violence on Tuesday played a big role. He came out very strongly after the protesters stormed Parliament and said that that the security apparatus would make sure that this didn't happen again. He called them, you know, criminals who had infiltrated the anti-tax protests. But at the same time, the police response, which was quite deadly, you know, more than 20 people killed and more injured, was kind of a shock to the country, I think. And there was a sort of backlash about it. The religious leaders, social organizations condemned it and said, you know, called for restraint. And also Mr. Ruto's international partners responded similarly. So I think given that all of that, and given that it felt really like there were sort of dangerous tensions building, he made the decision to step back.
The protesters were demanding that the bill be withdrawn, but they were also, some of them, demanding that President Ruto resign. More than 20 of them were killed. Do you think that they're now going to be placated with this, or will they, the protests continue?
Well, we've had reaction from some of the prominent activists on social media who have dismissed this move. They have said, for example, this is a PR gesture. This isn't going to bring our dead back. One other activist said, you know, basically don't trust Mr. Ruto. He's got some sort of agenda. We'll see you on the streets. So there is a will there to continue, and I expect that there probably will be demonstrations again. The next big one was called for Thursday, because that was the day Mr. Ruto was supposed to sign the bill, so they were all going to come out and try to prevent him or pressure him not to do that. So it may be that some of the pressures and the tensions will have been diffused and there will be less people out. It's not clear, because it seems there is still a will for some of the protesters to go out. And we will also need to watch closely how the security services respond, because, of course, the military was deployed by Mr. Ruto and it was quite severe on Tuesday. So how that will play out now after this turnaround remains to be seen.
Barbara Plett-Usher. You may have thought it worrying when Boeing aeroplanes seemed to be malfunctioning, an exit door blowing off mid-flight, allegations that safety procedures were regularly ignored. And now it's the company's spacecraft which is causing concern, not least for two astronauts stranded in space. Barry Wilmore and Sunita Williams were only supposed to spend 8 days at the International Space Station, but they've already been there for almost 3 weeks. And they've now been told there are still problems with the Boeing Starliner which brought them there and which was supposed to take them back to Earth. Evan Davis spoke to Susan Kilrain, an aerospace engineer. She explained what exactly the technical problems were.
There are a couple of issues that they're looking at, a helium leak being one and thruster issues being the other. The aircraft is safe. They technically could come home, but why? They are taking this time while they're in space to troubleshoot the issues, see if they can fix the issues, at the same time testing out some other things that are, you know, that they can do as targets of opportunity while they're there. The original return date wasn't a hard date. It was a no earlier than date. And then, you know, so it has slipped. And if all goes well, they'll be able to fix everything that's going wrong. But they'll definitely know more about it.
Susan, is there a plan B? I mean, I suppose it wouldn't be good for Boeing, but the plan B must be involving an Elon Musk spacecraft to take them back.
NASA always has a plan B. NASA doesn't like being one failure away from losing astronauts or spaceship or anything like that. So there's always enough seats up there to get everybody home safely. And there are. There's, you know, typically there's a Dragon, there's a Soyuz, now there's a Starliner. So there are enough seats there. If at any given time one of those vehicles becomes inoperable, they would send another one up. Of course, this time they wouldn't send another Starliner, but they would send probably a Dragon. Absolutely. They're safe.
Yep.
And
right.
They'll get back safely.
Okay, you're not sounding worried about the welfare of Sunny Williams and Butch Wilmore. What are they up to while they're there? How comfortable are they in the International Space Center? And obviously, they probably hadn't been anticipating they'd have two guests for so long. What would be the setup there?
They're definitely comfortable up there. And, you know, oftentimes there are guests, like when Axiom goes up in a Dragon, and there are places for these astronauts to sleep and food to eat and oxygen to breathe. Sonny and Butch probably wake up every day pinching themselves that they're still in space and they still get to maybe help out with the science, maybe help the space station crew get ready for their EVAs. So there's not really any concern there.
Susan Kilrain, an aerospace engineer and former NASA astronaut. Still to come.
They measured the decibels on rehearsals beforehand and they didn't think it would disrupt the animals at all.
But it seems it did. An animal conservation centre in Spain has blamed loud music from a festival for the deaths of several endangered gazelles. Next to the Middle East, Israeli tanks have been trying to force their way through a western suburb of Rafah, The city in the south of Gaza, which has already seen so much fierce fighting. Israel's military says its aircraft struck dozens of targets. The Hamas-run health authority said at least 60 people were killed in the last 24 hours alone. And as our Middle East regional editor Sebastian Usher reports from Jerusalem, all the signs are that this latest round of hostilities is set to continue.
The focus of the Israeli offensive has continued to be in Rafah, the southernmost city, where Israel says that remaining battalions of Hamas and potentially some of the hostages being held remain. And the focus has been over in the west of Rafah, with, as you were saying, Israeli tanks continuing to try to break through, and reports from Hamas and Palestinian sources, but they've met fierce resistance from both Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters. They've also continued to blow up buildings, essentially to clear the areas. There's some dramatic video that was posted by Palestinian media sources of a number of residential buildings being blown up at a roundabout. But it's not just in Rafah, and that's where, I guess you could say, the fighting, the military operation is still really continuing. In other parts, in the north, in a refugee camp there, eyewitnesses say that three Palestinians were killed, and in the centre, at another refugee camp, five reportedly killed. So it continues to be a big toll on the Palestinians, the attacks that Israel is continuing. But the numbers aren't the same that we saw in the phase of intense bombardment in the first months of the war, when 100, 120, 150 people were being killed each 24 hours. What we're seeing now is still very high figures, but between about 40 to 60 are being reported by the Gaza Health Ministry.
Sebastian Usher. A French appeal court has upheld an arrest warrant for the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad on war crimes charges and crimes against humanity. Such a warrant against a serving head of state is extremely rare. Mike Thompson reports.
President Assad stands accused, among other alleged crimes, of chemical weapons attacks on two opposition-held Damascus suburbs in 2013 that killed more than 1,000 people. The Paris Appeals Court has rejected the claim that he has absolute immunity as a serving head of state. Arrest warrants have also been issued for President Assad's brother, Maher, and two Syrian generals. The investigation has been conducted in France under what's called universal jurisdiction.
Mike Thompson. NATO has a new Secretary-General. The outgoing Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, will assume the post when the incumbent, Jens Stoltenberg, stands down at the beginning of October. And what a time to take on this role, with NATO facing what some believe to be the biggest crisis in its history. Russia invading Ukraine, the possibility of Donald Trump becoming US president again, a man whose support for NATO is far from guaranteed. Mr. Rutte has quite an inbox waiting for him, as our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
Mark Rutte said it was a tremendous honour to be appointed as the next head of NATO. But it's not a surprise. The outgoing Dutch Prime Minister's been the clear frontrunner for months. Mr. Rutte's well known on the global stage and is seen as a consensus builder. It's what's helped him stay in power for 14 years. Those skills will be key to keeping the 32-member alliance together. He's already managed to get the backing of some of NATO's more awkward members, Hungary and Turkey. But there'll be bigger tests, not least in dealing with the possibility of a second Trump term. Donald Trump has long been a sceptic of the alliance, but he got on with Rutte. Some US and European politicians question Mr. Rutte's suitability, given his record on military spending. He never met NATO's own 2% of GDP target. But since Russia's full-scale invasion, he has boosted Dutch defence spending and has led efforts to supply Ukraine with F-16 jets. President Zelensky hailed Mark Rutte as a principled and strong leader. And Jens Stoltenberg, who'll hand over in the autumn, said he was leaving the alliance in good hands.
Jonathan Beale. The Japanese yen has fallen to its weakest level against the US dollar for nearly 40 years, causing jitters on the markets and prompting concern that the authorities may again be forced to step in to boost the currency. James Wickham reports.
The yen's new low, down as much as 0.4% to 160.39 per dollar, is below the level at which officials stepped in back in April. The yen's lost more than 12% of its value this year, which is good for exports, as it means items are cheaper in overseas markets, but not for Japanese consumers, who are seeing the costs of imported goods rise steeply. Much of the pressure on the yen comes from years of low interest rates in the country, which now means there's a large gap between it and the US.
James Wickham. Saving animals from extinction is not exactly an easy task at the best of times, but a conservation centre in Spain has found the task particularly tough lately and with tragic results. The complex is near the southern Spanish town of Almería and has become the home for an endangered species of gazelle. But staff there say loud music from a nearby festival scared the animals so badly they panicked and ran into walls, breaking bones and leaving four of them dead. The BBC's Marlo Cusino has been following this story and told me first why the festival had been allowed to go ahead with vulnerable animals so close by.
They measured the decibels and on rehearsals beforehand, and they didn't think it would disrupt the animals at all. So the local authorities have said that the decibels measured were 65 decibels, which in their opinion was not enough to cause any huge disruption. But the conservation centre begs to differ on that front.
I gather that these gazelles are particularly sensitive to noise, is that right?
They are particularly sensitive to noise, particularly at this time of the year. So it's their breeding season right now. And the centre's vet who I spoke to said that because the gazelles are prey in their natural habitat, they tend to run away from anything that disturbs them. So it's not just the music, but it's also the vibration and everything around it. And by running away, they get so distressed, and some of them ran into walls, breaking their neck and legs. It was quite traumatic.
This is a particularly special kind of gazelle, is it, that they're seeking to preserve them?
Yes. So these gazelles, they're three different species at this conservation centre. And what makes them special is that they're native to northern Africa. But where they're from, originally, they're endangered and not able to survive in the wild as well. So this conservation centre serves the community, the biodiversity community worldwide. And it's hosted by Spain with support from the Spanish government for the last 60 years. And they've been able to build up numbers quite significantly to the point that now there are around 400 gazelles at the centre.
What have the organisers of the festival said about this suggestion that the music caused the death of these very special animals?
So the festival was organised by the city's authorities, and the city council said that they're very sorry for the deaths, but they believe the conservation centre has been quite hasty and, you know, a bit too quick to point the blame at them, because there's so many other factors involved, in their opinion, that it's not as clear-cut as that.
Marlo Cusino. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Callum McLean. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.